Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Roseanne Barr, whose latest book is Rose Anarchy, Dispatches from the Nut Farm. Earlier books, My Lives, Roseanne, My Life as a Woman. Roseanne Barr was the star and head writer of one of the most, if not the most, successful situation comedies on television in the 90s called Roseanne. Stand-up comedian, political activist over the years, talk show host, cooking show host.
That's true.
And also a celebrity, too, which I do want to talk about the nature of celebrity at some point.
Oh, I'd love to talk about it.
But let's start first with your decision to write this book. This book comes out 16 years after your previous book, which was My Lives, which was written during a very difficult time in your life. And you just decided to start blogging and suddenly got caught up into writing again? Is that what happened?
Well, I started blogging in 1995, introduced by Frank Zappa to the joys of the Internet. You know, I've always written. Every day I write. And I don't know. It was really about a very large spiritual and intellectual and moral transformation period between the time I wrote my last book and now. And I wanted people to know that I came out the other side. That's why I did it.
The book itself deals with different issues. At times it feels like a political blog. At times it feels like an attempt at stand-up comedy. And at times it's also a very serious autobiography, kind of interwoven.
Yeah, I like the way I did it. It's rants and essays, mostly humorous. And there is some history, some like autobiographical things that shaped me in my youth. I like that kind of woven into it is a kind of a code, like, you know, the Opus Dei code and all this stuff. I was talking about the Mary Magdalene code and all this stuff. I kind of did that myself, and there is a bit of a coded story in it that pays off at the end. It was really a fun way to write because, I don't know, I just thought of it while I was doing it. Like, this would be cool if you said, like, two or three things in chapter one and then three or four other things in chapter seven and then not again till chapter 13. But then, you know, just weaving with just a sentence of a real deep story about, you know, redemption kind of.
Do you feel you've now fully come out on the other side?
I certainly do.
Let me ask about the 1994 book. The sense I got was that this book, My Lives, was written by someone who claimed at that point that she was a multiple personality, made claims regarding abuse from her parents, made several claims regarding her family. And the question is, when you look back at My Lives, what are you looking at? Are you looking at an autobiography? Or are you looking at the thoughts of somebody who no longer exists? What do you see when you look back at that book?
I see a less aware me, a person who's fragmented and divided and is trying to get it together. And now, you know, I did. So now I'm like, wow, you know, it's kind of me, but it's kind of just partially me. Now that I have, you know, pretty much totally integrated after, you know, 17 years of therapy, you know, I see things differently, as would anybody who, you know, had some recovery from a debilitating mental illness.
And you've made peace with your family members as well.
Yeah, that's what Rose Anarchy is a lot about, is repentance and making amends and beginning anew. So, yeah, I made the amends, and I basically just kind of changed. I sort of evolved, changed, integrated, got whole, got well. I kind of did that whole thing, and I did it for real, and it was so awesome. And then, like, to actually do it, at times I didn't know if I could. It was like dragging myself across a floor of broken glass many times, psychological pain and, like, horror, just horror, fear, and all the things that mental illness gives you, you know, it brings along with you. But I did it. It's so awesome that I did it. I just want people to know that they could do it, too, and so on my blog, I always write the meditations that helped me. I also want to say that it wasn't just this fantastic psychiatrist named Dr. Colin Ross who helped me to heal from dissociative identity disorder, but also, I learned to meditate at the very same time because I got like real. I've always been a Kabbalist because everybody in my family was a Kabbalist from the time I was born. My grandmother, my grandfather, everybody was a Kabbalist. So I always had that. I didn't just get it because Madonna did it. You know, and I've always had that as my strength. And there's part of Kabbalah. It's all this other crap. I'm not going to say crap. I shouldn't say that. But things with people thinking about it, it's red strings and blah, blah. You know, it's just meditation. And it's a great form of meditation, and it really helps you to marshal all of your inner forces and get them on the same side so they can do the right thing at the right time for the right reason. And just doing that, it sounds so simple to say the right thing at the right time for the right reason. But that's so hard for people to do. It was so hard for me to do. I do like the right thing three or four times, and then the fifth thing would be the wrong thing that would remove it. I couldn't figure how to stay on track and conscious and aware. You know, that's right. Just what happens when you have, you know, problems like that. You know, I was drugged for a long time, and that kind of helped me, the drugs in one way. It helped me to not be so bipolar and up and down and like kind of out there. But then it kind of kills your creativity. So I had to learn to live without any psychiatric drugs on top of it with what's left of, you know, some inner division. But, you know, I've done it. It's so cool that I can't, whenever I say it, that's why I wrote Rosanarchy. I guess it was for myself, like to go, hey, you know, this is a whole new world now. You don't have to have all this internal conflict and internal war. You can, like, just be peaceful, and then you can kind of try to talk about making the world a peaceful place, too, but it has to start inside you for sure.
During the period when you were having these difficulties, you were also incredibly creative in terms of writing the Roseanne Show, in terms
of
acting.
Yeah, the crazy always goes with the – that was something. And then, like – then you get on the pills, and then you're, like, sane, but then nobody likes your work. That's how it goes.
Right.
And I figured, wow, it's so weird. What would it be like if I was okay and not on, you know, I was at the best time of my actual life, and my work was my best work. What would that be like? And that took a lot, and that's kind of what writing that book was about. Like, well, I could stay not crazy and write and be creative and still not be having to have drama to dredge up the writing thing. Because, I mean, I had all these, like a lot of writers, you have things that, you know, you look for to kind of drive you nuts so you can write, I guess. Like you get in bad marriages and you, I don't know what you do.
A comedian will always use his or her material, or any writer, as fodder for their work. I mean, that's part of the process.
Yeah, but it's
right?
Like if you're drinking enough, it's like which is coming first, the fodder or the work? Because you're kind of creating it, you know?
Right.
It's like, whoa, and you got to stay on top. It's like riding. It is like riding a dragon. And when that creativity, that manic energy, I guess it is, if you're going to go like that, that manic high thing, wow, you really got to ride that. And you got to try to regulate it. And like then you got to stay out of the depths of the depression that follows. That's some hard stuff to do and stay funny and cool.
And
be able to pay your bills and, you know, that.
Well, on top of that, of course, you also had to deal with the craziness of being a celebrity, too.
Yeah, on top of the crazy, like in the book, in a Rosanarchy I write, you would think that, you know, most of bipolar delusionals were, you know, locked up, but they certainly weren't starring in a number one sitcom. But I was.
Well, and in addition to that, you know, most paranoids don't have people sending them hate mail
either. No, that was a big one. The paranoid one was really scary. It still is. It's like, oh, my God, I've got to transverse way too many football fields of logic to get into. Okay, that person is not, like, following you. And then they are. And then they jump out from inside your closet, and like you're already paranoid because you've got the mental, but then they're actually there. It's like so scary you couldn't even imagine.
A Roseanne bar.
Thank God for alcohol is all I have to say. And the medicinal marijuana. I'm seriously wanting to talk about medicinal marijuana, and the legalization of marijuana is a large part of not only my book, Rosanarchy, but of my presidential campaign.
The Green Tea Party.
Green Tea Party, legalizing marijuana, getting rid of drug laws, and I also will give free health care, forgive all student loans, every single thing, and I'll do it with only a fraction of a daily military budget.
That would probably work.
Yes, it would.
Roseanne Barr, I'd like to ask you some questions that some friends of mine have asked me and to ask you,
okay.
And I'm curious about.
All right.
How exactly did the Roseanne show start, and what kind of influence did you have on this very early episode?
Well, it was my stand-up act. And they came and said, we want you to have your own show. And I'm like, cool. And they go, here's a guy who's going to help you write it. Cool. And then, you know, he just came and hung out with my family and watched my act. And then we, like, built this show.
And how did John Goodman come into the picture?
Well, I picked him. They brought people in to audition for the roles. And I picked him, of course. You know, after him, there was, like, hold the presses. This guy is, like, so – he was just a doll. He was a darling guy. I thought he was handsome as hell, and he was fatter than me, so that was like that was very important. And he was funnier than hell. That guy, just that first day, was a blast. So I knew I was gonna marry that guy, and I still say he still is my husband too. Dan Connor and John Goodman are always gonna be my husband.
In those days, how much control in that first season did you have over the show? Was there a different showrunner then, or?
I had all the control always from day one, as I knew, and there was just some crazy people that didn't get it. They didn't agree, and they tried to wrest power from me, and, you know, they did it to their own demise, as, you know, I don't even know why they would even bother, but they did. I guess sometimes I think just because they were men, they had to do it. But there was never any question that that was my act in my life and that, you know, that I was this character and that she was me. And we were going to talk about working mothers. Like, they came in and they'd start messing with me, the writers, talk about the paranoid thing. And plus, not liking people that much. Loving the idea of people, but the one-on-one is hard because they're covered with germs and they sweat and stuff. They're freaking me out. So, you know, they come back and it's written on paper and they began a war with me. I read the initial pilot and I was like, yes, and it wasn't even me. It was like, yes, Dan, and then what shall we do? It was everything I wasn't. And the reason they sign, it's like Margaret Cho talks about, they sign you and then the first thing they do is tell you you can't be the person they signed. So they tried to make me all the things that I wasn't, and they made Laurie Metcalf's character, Jackie, into me, the Roseanne. And she even's like, what have they done? Even her, you know. And so I said, why have you done this? And I went up and confronted. And they go, because we don't think nobody's going to like you. That's what they, I go, well, why the F did you sign me then? What's the matter with you people? And then began like the whole churning, swirling insanity that even to think straight drove me crazy because I couldn't be as crazy as them. I couldn't be as crazy as them no matter what. So I just started kind of doing it myself.
How did that work? Did you finally just say, listen, this is it. Either the show is the way I want to do it, or
yeah,
I can't do it at all.
Yeah, they try to mess with me. Like further, like they got me in the bed, and I was supposed to say some disgusting thing to Dan Connor, and I just like I would never say I'm not going to do a castration joke. You know, I wish I could swear on here because I do swear, but I'm like, are you crapping me? Are you crapping a load right here? I'm not going to do that. I'm smarter than that. That isn't how I am, right? I'm not little Annie Fanny from the Playboy comics. You know, I'm not that. It's like they were just so brainwashed or something. They couldn't think to write for a woman character at all. And so I just go like, I changed the line and I said, I'd rather say this. And they say, no, say it as written. I'm like, are you crapping a boatload of crap? I'm not going to say it as written. This is my show. I'm not going to say that. And so then my lawyers came.
Yeah.
Three of my lawyers came and three of their lawyers came from the network. They stood toe to toe and argued whether I should tell a castration joke or not. And that took about 4 hours.
And this was in one of the first shows.
Yeah. And so I'm like, this is ridiculous. And they wouldn't turn off the cameras. So it was just a camera on me on the bed going, I'm waiting for a line change because that's what my lawyer said. I go, I want out of here. I want out. Let me go. And he's like, if you walk off, you're going to lose the show. Don't let him do this to you. Don't let him win. And I'm like, I don't win. What do you mean win? I want out of here. I've been sitting here for 4 hours. I don't care anymore. You win. I said, you guys win. I don't care anymore. That's what you wanted, I guess. That I wouldn't care and wouldn't want to do it. So, okay, you win. And then all of a sudden, it was like this huge whoosh that went out of the room, and my sister came in, and my sister brought me The Art of War by, you know, that awesome book.
Sure.
And I just sat there and read that out to him. Because the one who cares the most wins, and so I just like try to psych myself into saying over and over, the one who cares the most wins. I care more than you guys, so I guess that means I win, or else I don't care at all, and that means I lose. So which is it? And it was just like so crazy making. And then finally I said, that guy's out of here. It's him or me. And then they said, okay, that took them a while. Here's the first thing, they went to Goodman and Lori and they said, will you do the show without her? You know, if John or Lori had said yes, I wouldn't ever had a show. Because they did that to Valerie Harper, and, you know, they don't like any woman getting control of anything. I mean, now they do, they say, but I don't know, this was way back then. So John and them said, no, we're not, we want to be on the show with her. And George Clooney was on the show, and I remember he went and put up this sign on my door that said Sandy Duncan. Because they had fired her the same way.
Right, yeah.
He said they were going to bring Sandy Duncan in to play me. And then after they found out nobody would do it without me, then they came back and decided they were going to be on my side against the writer. But then they told me, he's got a contract and you got to work with him for 13. He's relieved of duty, but I got to still put up with him and hating me for 13. And then, like, they take their war to the script, you know. They paint your character broad and horrible. And, I mean, they know what they're doing. They're crazy people with mother problems. They're crazier than I'd ever be. But at least I'm in therapy, for Christ's sake. And they're not. And it's like they just kept putting it in my face and putting it in my face. And it was really hard. And if I didn't have Lori and John and my crew, which was, you know, everybody who worked on the stage, I never would have lived through it. Like my sound guys, my, you know, wardrobe guys, you know, everybody who was blue collar on the show, it just became like class warfare.
At a certain point, you know, the show became a hit, and it became a hit because of you, not because of the guy that they got rid of.
Well, none of them will say that even today.
Really?
They still don't know. They won't give me any credit. The show was never, like, I'm never called a writer. It's always like actress. You know, the last thing I am is an actress, trust me. I'm a writer and a comic, you know, number one on writer. You know, when people say, did you have anything to do with anything on that show? It just drives me crazy, but I have to let go of it.
You're listening to an interview with Roseanne Barr, whose latest book is Rose Anarchy, Dispatches from the Nut Farm. You also mentioned being lucky enough to spend time with Shelley Winters.
Loved her. She was the funniest, and we had Estelle Parsons, too, and me and Laura used to always say, that's us when we're old. And I feel so imprinted by Shelley Winters. She was just like my grandma. She looked like my grandma, and she acted like her, too. She was such an artist that could, like, create another human. I admired her talent greatly.
Well, do you think that over the course of those years, you know, somewhere along the line, you picked up your own acting skills, I'm sure.
I think I did.
I mean, if you look at the later shows, I'm sure you feel more confident than maybe the first couple.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
The acting thing, I remember Goodman. I told him, I don't know how to do this. It was a complicated thing. And he said, acting is listening. He goes, just watch what I do and react to it. And I was like, ping, hey, it isn't hard at all. But like having John and Lori, as well as Estelle and Shelley, I mean, I was always studying the craft of acting from them because they were like some of the greats.
Well, what was the relationship between the written script and the actual show? I mean, how much room was there for improv in the context of the show?
Well, we were always rewriting. Like, you know, I always give notes all through the process every day. Like every time we read it, think of a joke. Or, you know, sometimes John would throw a joke. We had room for improvisation. It's very small. Sometimes more than others. But we always wrote the show right up until we were taping it. After the first initial 13, I was able to bring in some fantastic writers that I liked, and they've all gone on to pretty great careers, a lot of people from that show.
You talk a little bit about Sandra Bernhardt, mm-hmm. and before Ellen came out, there was Roseanne.
Right. That kind of comes out that there was Sandra, because Sandra was like the first gay artist who said she was gay. And she was so vilified for having the gall. I mean, you know, she had the bravery to do it, and people were, like, vilifying her she said she was bisexual. And they really went crazy over that. It was like, she was the first person who ever did anything like that.
Did you get any flack from the network for that?
Yeah, they didn't want to do it, of course. You know, it had been done before, to be fair. Billy Crystal played the first television gay, maybe not, you know, the first out television gay character in that show, Soap. So he had greased the way a little bit for us, but No, they didn't want us to have any gay characters. No, they definitely didn't really want that. They didn't want us to have a lot of things. Like they didn't want us to have friendship between black and white either. Just all the most bizarre, backward social mores that they wanted to protect because they thought that people would get mad and not buy their toothpaste or something. But, you know, I mean, I think my show kind of proved that people are, you know, not as dumb as they think they are.
Well, your show, as you mentioned in the book, was a big hit the same time the Cosby Show was as well.
Yeah.
And the
Cosby had been on for a number, four or five years, I think.
Yeah.
Three or four years?
Last year I interviewed Colson Whitehead, who's a black writer, grew up in a middle-class environment, and he said watching a show like Cosby was astonishing for him because he'd never seen an actual family like his on television because they were all ghetto people. And I know that a number of friends of mine say the same thing that in terms of Roseanne, that this was the first realistic blue-collar show. There had been shows before like Jackie Gleason, but this was the first realistic one.
Yeah, because it had a strong mother. That's the first, you know, that was a new thing, too. It was like my act. It was just how I lived, you know. It was how everybody around me that I grew up with lived.
It lasted for 9 years, and in the final year, you decided to have Roseanne win a lottery.
Right.
And then you took it back in the last episode.
I don't know that I took it back. I didn't take it back. It was a way to integrate it into my life, where I was trying to tell the difference between being rich and being poor and how I saw it from both sides. So that was the device I used in order to talk about that. And in the end, I do write about this in Roseanne Archie, that the character Roseanne, she wins the lottery. It's actually at the loss of her husband at her lowest point in life, she begins to write a story about a woman who lost her union job and then wins the lottery and buys the factory in the town and gives it to the townspeople. It was a lot of integration of my political and everything, things in there, but that's exactly kind of what the Roseanne Show ended up to actually be for me as, you know, a human that the actual behind, well, I should put that in another book, but Roseanne Connor wrote her own book. She became a writer and she wrote a book. And that's what, you know, in the third episode of the Roseanne Show, Roseanne's great longing is to be a writer. So I gave her what she wanted, you know. And I got to say all those other political things about, like, rich people and how they are and poor people and how they are and how the two Americas.
After that, you did a talk show for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And you did a cooking show as well. This was the period when you were still dealing with the tail end of the relationship with Tom Arnold, which you talk about in depth in Roseanne.
Oh, yeah, I do talk about it in depth. It was sad.
When you look back on that, it seems as if that allowed you to play out, I guess, certain fantasies that a lot of people have had about what it's like to be wealthy, both the positive and the negative side of it.
Yeah, money does change everything. That's for damn sure. It really does change everything. Then in the end, you're like, boy, everything that money changed, it, none of it was any good. That's kind of what I figured out. It wasn't any good. All those childhood dreams that, oh, if you were had money and fame, that you know you'd feel good then, didn't work. None of it worked. But it's not to say it wasn't great having money. But in the end, it was like, what am I going to do with this money? After I started thinking it was bad to have money, I started giving my money away. And that's when people really think you're crazy. Talk about crazy. And I gave so much money away because I was like, it's not right that I have this money. Because I was raised a socialist and what am I, F it. I like bankrolled every lunatic thing and a whole bunch of stuff and some good stuff for kids. But I learned something there. I learned a lot. I did everything I wanted to do. Money allowed me to do everything I wanted to do and go everywhere as I wanted to go and buy everything I wanted to buy. I did every single bit of it.
And, of course, on the other side is the celebrity factor, the fact that you have to have paparazzi every time you get out the door and you can't go out for a drink on your own either.
I never just went out because it's like, well, if you don't want paparazzi, then don't go out. So I learned that. But, you know, there's such good parts of being famous. The big part of it is any table, any restaurant. Oh, With no reservations either. It's so awesome. That was the best part. You know, there were a lot of things that were good and a lot that were bad. Having crazy people, like I said, when you're paranoid anyways, and crazy people are jumping out of your garbage and stuff, you know, it takes a few ticks off your heart, the stress, that kind of stress. But, you know, I mean, nothing I ever went through could compare to somebody losing their home or any, you know what I mean? So it's right. All relative.
Well, the other side of it, too, is that you get a chance in books like Rose Anarchy, but also on radio and television shows, to make a point about feminism in particular. There's a very serious chapter about life in the feminist world in Denver in the 70s. And I kept thinking of life in Berkeley in the 70s and actually life in Berkeley here at KPFA today, the left eats its own head and tail.
Right. But you know what? Yeah. But we lefties are going to have to decide that we're going to get on board and we're going to support each other and we're going to carry it all the way through. And that is missing because a lot of people, you know, I mean, they get distracted with shiny objects or groupies or drugs or whatever. They're always getting distracted. But it's always an ego thing. It's always like, I'm not like them. That's what's wrong with the left, in my opinion. It's like, hey, ever heard of these words? Coalesce, unity, support. As my hero, Harvey Milk, said, and this is a great place to quote him, when the gay people got in with the unions, when the people of this country who are not right, everybody else but that little tiny number, when we figure out how to agree on something, look out. It'll be over in a day. It'll be everything we want in a day because we got to, like, stop doing that I'm smarter than those guys crap. We have to coalesce and unify. That's the only thing that can save us. And by God, we better start doing it.
You had a pretty clear appraisal of what happened in the 70s as this feminist bookstore just compartmentalized, fell apart, attacked one another.
They used, you know, you always have to talk about an agitator or someone who, and there's always, it's always about that. COINTEL. It's always that. Just like the trolls. I mean, they know how to keep us from unifying and getting a piece of the American dream. They know how to keep people from getting any money. All they care about is separating people from their money. So I can see it. It's just so possible. It's just so close and so possible. In Rose Anarchy, I say, I don't seriously know if men can do it. Seriously, I know people get mad at me. I know women can do it, and I know women who are of my generation, and maybe the men, too, that are of my generation. I'm talking about grandparents. I think we could really go a long way towards uniting people to get together and work to solve actual problems. I think we could do that. I feel like it's kind of so exciting to think about a whole bunch of grandmothers out there. And of course, I do think grandmothers, the richest women who've ever lived, the most educated women who've ever lived, the freest women who've ever lived, the most spiritual women who've ever lived right now. And I just feel like we can find a way to weave ourselves through all of these separate things that are all artificial, such as, you know, race. All that stuff is completely artificial. The only one that's not artificial is class. And we can find our way past that, too. I mean, I really think we could, like, really all pull together and really be the change ourselves. We're not going to get it from any leaders, but every grandma in her own house or her own community or her own block can do it and knows how to do it and knows how to do it cheap. I just want to encourage that, solutions and unity.
Roseanne Barr. I'd like to ask you about some stuff that's not in the book. First of all, you directed 2 episodes of Roseanne. How was directing yourself?
I went berserk. It was fun because I'm my favorite performer. I'm the only one who had the balls to say that. No, I loved it because I love to think, I could do this, then I can do that. And, you know, I have a big imagination. But I kind of actually went berserk and drove everybody crazy the time where I directed, and that's the one time that Goodman turned on me, and he actually went to the network and asked to be released from his from the rest of his contractual, because he's like, I can't take it. This is what I was told. She's just too, and I was way too Cecil B. DeMille. Like, I told my head writer, I want you to get me 70 acrobats. He goes, we can't get 70 acrobats. I go, I want... understand. I go like, if I'm not looking at you, you do not exist. I went way overboard. People did not like me on that show.
Well, it's great you have a sense
overboard.
Of humor about
I went
it
overboard. I tend to go overboard.
Well,
not
that,
so much now, but
no.
Then.
Well, then, of course, this is the famous story of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Oh, that, I went so overboard on that. But, you know, well, I have two things to say. That was one where I was, like, going to play it for serious. I had no intention of screwing up. You know, my whole life I've loved singing. And I was sure I was going to do good. But I was so stupid that I was like, I sang it 3,000 times. I knew all the words. But I knew nothing about key. And I thought I didn't have to. Because I just was used to going, oh, you know. But here I started up here, oh. And there was nowhere to go. And I had no idea. But like about 5 notes in, I'm like, oh, my God, there's no way I'm going to hit the high note.
And you didn't stop and start again, which was...
That's the point of Rosanarchy. Stop. And start again. You can always do that. I still wanted to stop and start again, but I was afraid I'd get in trouble for I don't know what.
As opposed to what happened.
As opposed to what happened. I wish I could have stopped and started again, but by that time it's like, oh my God, it took on a life of its own that went berserk. I have apologized about 1 million times for that. And here's my line. I know this is a Christian country, but can't they forgive me anyway? Because, I mean, people cannot let that go. No matter how many times, you know, that I tell them what happened and that it wasn't. I mean, the next day it was like the president is saying that I thought it was a disgrace. You know, George Big Bush, Daddy-O. I'm like, your son just ripped off every old woman in the world. And it was just like so ugly and it just kept going.
Well, hopefully by now it's pretty much forgotten.
It isn't, actually.
Really?
Yes, and it's always referenced. Almost every job that I've tried to get, it's always referenced at the last two levels where you write the check and get hired. It's still, I've written about that.
What's the story behind the movie She-Devil?
Faye Weldon wrote a book, and Susan Seidelman brought it to film, and I got to play that lady. I didn't like how it turned out. I thought she didn't do a good job replicating the book. I was a big fighter. I fought everybody. I should have kept my mouth shut, you know. I would have got another movie job.
Well, how was working with Meryl Streep?
I didn't even get a scene with her. I think we said hello. And me and her went to the writers and we're like, could we have a scene together since every poster has us fighting? They said no.
You did two voiceovers. One was Look Who's Talking, the other Home on the Range.
Yeah, they were both fun.
When you did those, you were in a studio by yourself, right?
Well, with the director and all the other people that goes around with the director.
So you didn't get a chance to interact with anyone else, though?
No, never.
That's terrible.
Isn't it weird? It's like the way it, and I never got directed either, except for Susan Seidelman. But, yeah, it's like it is kind of weird how things turn out. But then on the other hand, my stuff doesn't go like anybody else's ever, and it never has.
One point where I kind of scratched my head and said, this is cool, is you used to hang out with Heath Ledger, and both of you talked about how ridiculous you thought acting was.
Yeah, just how it's like pretending. It's like, oh, the great, all the BS. It's just pretending. And then you just put, like, levels on the pretending. It's like being a kid and playing in your room. It's really fun.
Well, you also mentioned that you were still astonished at what a great actor Ledger had become from the time you knew him.
After he was dead, man, that's a whole freaky thought. But the Joker, I never saw anything like it. It's just, and everybody knows it too. Oh, my God. The big, full-faced acting was just ungodly great.
Roseanne Barr, now you've given your Green Tea Party ticket idea. What are we talking about here? Are we talking something like Pat Paulson? Are we talking about an educational moment? What exactly are you doing with this idea of running for president?
Well, I'm putting it out there. It's not just president, but it's also prime minister of Israel. It's a twofer. So that I can solve all the world's problems within 30 days because I know how. Because I have the solution. And I just felt like, you know, I'm a meditator and a mystic. So I feel like, hey, I have all these answers come to me and I write them down. And they're good solutions. Like I have a lot of solutions for world problems. So why not put them out there and then say, if you want to elect me as president of the United States, go ahead. And if I am elected, you know, I'll definitely show up and I'll serve the American people like nobody's business has ever served the American people. I'll serve the taxpayers. I'll serve the mothers. I'll serve the troops. I'll serve the people who do the actual work in this country and are, like, looked down on for it. I'll actually do it, and within 30 days, I will also create world peace because I know how to do it. So I'm putting it out there if people want me or if they just want to read my solutions, they can have their choice.
Yeah, so you think that if you get into that position, you wouldn't suddenly turn into the Roseanne who directed two episodes?
I have learned, and Roseannearchy is about, like when I went to my rabbi and I said, well, you know, he's like, you know what he told me? He told it to me straight. He goes, you can still, because I had trouble spiritually, you know. And he goes, hey, you can still be the biggest bitch around. It's just like, who are you going to be the bitch to? It can't be people. And I was like, okay, I get that. So I can be the biggest bitch on earth still to the evil part of my own self. And, boy, that creates a nice circuit for me to do good things in the world because I am a natural-born bitch. And that's why I tried to get, like, 1 million American bitches to come and join up with me on Mother's Day in Washington, D.C. That's where I kicked off my campaign. And I'll be giving my second Mother's Day speech there again this year. And I want just the world to know, and they can access my speech on RoseanneWorld.com. I want the world to know that I know how to fix the world, and my solutions are for free. And even if I am elected president, I'm not going to take a dime. You know why? Because when you have answers and solutions, it's better than money.
Roseanne Barr, aside from writing the book and running for president and prime minister of Israel,
and also having a huge messianic complex that has defied psychiatry, drugs, and stardom and sanity.
Given all of that, what else are you doing these days?
I'm saving the world.
You doing more stand-up comedy?
No. Here's how I'm saving the world, very briefly. I'm raising the macadamia nut on my farm. I'm a farmer. I'm going to do a thing called charity farming. If anybody wants to know about it, they can come on my website and read about it. But the macadamia nut, this is why I feel God has put me on this earth to say two things. One, the macadamia nut is the perfect protein. It has no carbohydrate and is full of fat, but it's the good fat that the human body needs. It's like manna growing on the trees. And if we start getting our protein from macadamia nuts, we won't need cheeseburger farming, hence no greenhouse gases. I think of these solutions. The other thing is, my other solution for all world problems is for grandmothers to get together and actually have a bowl session where we all share our solutions. Because one thing grandmothers are about is solutions. And sometimes they can fix anything real cheap, sometimes just with a paper clip. I like to summon that energy and call those grandmothers to me, and that we might be able to come up with a nice bowl session and some thought-provoking solutions that we can present power and actually solve a GD problem on the face of this earth. It would be so cool to solve something. I just want to say, because there is solutions. That's what gets me so right. Mad, you know. It's like I put all my OCD and all my mental thing towards seeking solutions.
Big Island, I've been there, and it's kind of isolated.
Well, I live in a rainforest, yes. But you know who's coming to the Big Island? I shouldn't say coming to, but there are a lot of visionary women of my age on the Big Island. And, you know, I have fallen under the spell of visionary women and men of my age in the rainforest. And it's an intensely cool way to live, write, and enjoy my later years.
You've been listening to an interview with Roseanne Barr, whose latest book is Roseannearchy, Dispatches from the Nut Farm. Are those seasons of Roseanne, are they on DVD now?
Yes, they are on DVD, 9 seasons of Roseanne. And they put out a couple extra ones, like there's one of the Thanksgiving specials and one of all the Halloween shows. So there's probably about 10. I also have 3 or 4 or 5 HBO specials that are out there available on DVD, and this is my third book. And I also have a children's DVD out there, which you can find on Amazon, called Calling All Kids, where it's like real granny rock.
And there's also a blog, an ongoing blog at RoseanneWorld.com.
Mm-hmm. And I'm a farmer.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.